Namaskar.
Bienvenue.
I'm from Bangalore, India.
Dublin, Ireland.
Turkey.
The Philippines.
This is Feet into Words.
I came here to study.
To work. To volunteer.
Build a life of my own.
Welcome to Feet into Words.
Esto es Con los pies en dos mundos.
Bir ayağım burada, bir ayağım orada yaşıyorum.
Welcome to Feet into Worlds.
A social movement born in India has crossed the globe. Indian Americans are taking to the streets to protest an epidemic of corruption in India. I'm Ashwini Anbarajan, a reporter for Feet in Two Worlds. A modern-day Mahatma Gandhi, Anna Hazare, has inspired the movement and led hunger strikes and mass protests to pressure the Indian government to pass a powerful anti-corruption bill. Joining us by phone today to talk about the India Against Corruption movement is S. Mitra Kalitha, a journalist and author.
Hi, how are you?
And here in the studio is Atul Kumar, who helped organize the first protests in support of the anti-corruption movement here in New York. Hi, Atul. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Swini. Great to be here.
Mitra, can you describe why these protests are happening in India and the impact it's had on the country?
There's been this tide of corruption that has plagued India for decades now. It was something that very much just became a part of the way things were. So I think most Indians have kind of accepted that, you know, in order to get certain things done, corruption became pretty much a part of day-to-day life. Over the last 18 months to 2 years, there's been a number of scandals that have really affected this government that basically forced people to say enough is enough. Anna Hazare is a figure who's actually from Maharashtra and had done, you know, a lot of work in his own village to kind of clean up, you know, where funds were going there, to empower people to be more self-governing, if you will. So he certainly has a history as a leader, but it was much more local, if you will. Over the last year or so, he started to stage hunger strikes. And hunger strikes are a very common method of protest in India. So that's nothing new. But I think the combination of this enough is enough sentiment with what we saw were several scandals that the government was going through just reached this fever pitch. And, you know, you saw this man who's somewhat Gandhian in his both approach and his look really start to galvanize all classes across India to protest, to march, to join his hunger strike, that kind of a thing.
Atul, you're a businessman, you're an entrepreneur. Why does corruption in India matter to an Indian American like you in the United States?
Aswini, corruption should matter to all of us because it reduces, as Mitra said, the quality of life. At the same time, most of us, our parents are in India, and day-to-day basis, our friends and family, they experience corruption on a day-to-day basis. More importantly, when we go from US to India, we start experiencing the fallouts of a corrupt system right from the airport, where you have to pay a bribe to clear the customs, you have to pay bribe at every stage. It's all pervasive. So that's one reason. The other reason why it matters so much to us, most Indians in the last couple of decades, I would say, Indians have started to have that sense of pride and assertion that India is a great country and is bouncing back after decades of, you know, underdevelopment. But all that confidence and pride goes away when you hear that the very leaders of your proud country are involved in these very scandalous corruption scams.
So, Atul, who's participating in the protests here in the United States? Are they young? Are they old? Are they immigrants that have been here for a long time? Or are they just new immigrants? Can you describe the protests and your involvement in it as well?
In these protests, I mean, we started from January, the very week when the protest started in India in Jantar Mantar. Very small group of about 15 of us assembled in Union Square. But we got a very lukewarm, or sometimes very negative response initially that why should we put a bad name to our country in an outside, why should we publicize all the corruption in India, in U.S. and all that?
So to understand this, initially, people were in the United States were saying, we don't want to do this. It makes India look bad.
Right. I mean, I'll give you some examples. Somebody said that why you don't wash your dirty laundry outside on the streets of Times Square. Somebody said that, Atul, if you really feel so strongly about corruption, what are you doing here? Go back to India. Don't do all this drama here. So that was the type of initial messages. But slowly, as we persisted and as people started to learn more about the movement, then the support started to build up.
Can you just describe quickly the protests that you have held and what you've seen kind of grow across the country?
So as I was saying, our very first protest happened at the Gandhi statue in Union Square in the very frigid winter of January. It was on January 29th. About 15 people turned up, mostly some of them are doctors, some engineers, very few MBAs. My classmates didn't like it. But in April, I remember 9th of April, Anna was on fast for 5 days. I was sitting at Columbia for some program. I had gone there. I created a Facebook event on Thursday. And by Friday evening, 700 plus people had signed up that they are coming. And the event was simple, NYC for Anna at Times Square. And I was overwhelmed with the type of response we got, because between January and April, a lot of people had started to follow up the story and interest had grown and people's frustration had grown that this 74-year-old old person is on a hunger strike for the last 5 days and government is still not buzzing. So there was a lot of passion generated by that time. I'll also give a little bit of credit to cricket. The very previous week to this event, India won the World Cup. The sentiment after 28 years. So the sentiments were very, very high. People, I mean, I was in where I live in Newport. People were on the street almost, again, 400, 500 people on the streets of Newport, on the cars and the road and shouting Vande Mataram, Janaga. I mean, people were very, very emotional the very previous week. So maybe some of that high emotion was a rollover to the next weekend when we organized this movement in support of Anna.
Mitra, you mentioned this before, and I want to return to this idea, and Atul had just said that as well. This is a 74-year-old man. He's going on hunger strikes. He's lost weight. He believes in a peaceful movement. Is he a modern-day Mahatma Gandhi?
Some would say he's the closest thing to a Gandhian figure that India has. I think he's somebody who's able to, again, mobilize people in a way, and middle-class people, too, because remember, in India, the poor vote, and that, you know, is something that politicians have counted on, have banked on for decades. It's been a lot harder to get the middle class, which really have benefited from the fruits of India's liberalization and its economic prowess over the last few years, to kind of speak out that, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't, you know, be able to, you know, open your business and sell your jeans and then on the same token, you know, pay these bribes and not pay your workers what you're supposed to. I'm just,
right,
you know, coming up with a flip example there. But
so I think this gets to the next point we really want to explore, which is that India, ironically, is a democracy of a billion people. Its wealthiest and maybe most stable population, the middle class, does not vote. The poor do vote. And on Facebook, I personally have seen Indians describe this as their quote-unquote spring, referencing the revolutions that have happened in North Africa and the Middle East. Do you think something has changed in India because of these protests? Is there going to be greater social engagement? And Atul and Mitra both, please comment on this. Are we going to see lots of Indians begin to vote and take a bigger role in their own government?
The Facebook movement is striking because I would describe this as India's Arab Spring, because India, as you mentioned, is already a democracy, has already seen, it has a really, you know, it's a young country, but that, you know, every decade has kind of some major protest that you could kind of point to as symbolic. So, you know, I really hope that this in some ways did wake up the middle class from its slumber. And I think there's certainly been this emergence of a new global Indian over the last, you know, 10 to 20 years. And so there's a lot more fluidity, but somehow that hasn't translated to the vast majority of India's population, which, you know, is largely poor, largely agricultural, you know, does not make its living off of something connected to the economic reforms.
Right. And Atul, what do you think?
I agree with Mitra that it is not exactly the Arab Spring, because India is a democracy, unlike very dictatorial or non-democratic countries in the Middle East. But I would still also draw some parallels with the Arab Spring in the sense that for the first time, the middle class of India came on the streets, which is very unusual. It doesn't do that. Secondly, you don't have, I mean, for me, it was a shocker. I was pleasantly surprised that if within 48 hours, 450 plus people assemble in Times Square, it doesn't happen very often for Indians. To get, Mitra would also know, to organize an event in of NRIs in US in New York area, 50 people event, 100 people event requires a lot of effort, months of effort. And the fact that within 48 hours, without using any media, mainstream media, we could gather 450 plus people in Times Square. So that really spoke of something.
NRI stands for Non-Resident Indian. And it's a term that's used pretty globally to anyone that. Why don't you describe it, Atul?
I mean, NRI also has become a fun word. Also, it originally it actually means non-resident Indians, but the level of disengagement many NRIs, people living outside, had with India, sometimes people would joke at it as non-reliable Indians. Because, I mean, but now we're trying to change the definition of we are as connected and we really care about India. So this movement and the support we provided, that provided another sort of confidence that people, the sons of soil who have moved away from home, they care about things in India as much as people living there.
I think that very much is kind of the takeaway of this, is also the social media in India over the last year to 18 months really did allow, even some of the corruption scandals in government were not getting, in my opinion, were not initially getting adequate media attention. And it was through Twitter and through Facebook and, you know, through demands that this has to be covered, that these issues were sort of able to rise to the top of the news agenda.
I mean, I agree with much of what Mitra says. One addendum to that would be that Facebook and Twitter, who are the user base of those media? Very high influential people. People like I could send out a message to S. Mitra Kalita via her Facebook or Twitter, or to somebody like a Sri Srinivasan, who's like the most connected Indian in the world I know. So that way, even though in terms of numbers, most Indians still don't have internet, but the fact that NRI community could provide that media outlet. So even though in terms of number would be just 400, 500 people in Times Square, but this is the message I was getting from the core team of India Against Corruption movement, people like Arvind Kejriwal, Sivendra Singh Chauhan, who actually launched the Facebook phase for this movement. So before Anna Hazare was arrested, the night before that, he actually sent me a message that, Atul, there is a chance that most of the core members, might be in jails and we don't know for how long. Can you guys in US help us manage our Facebook page? And I actually still manage their Facebook page. So that Facebook and Twitter, not only for external communication, but for some of the internal coordination as a communication line, that had a very effective, powerful role. That is something which might not have been as visible to the external world. The external mainstream media might not even notice it. But behind the screen, a lot of communication was happening through these private channels, through these Facebook pages and groups.
What do you think is going to happen next? And also, what does this mean for you on a sentimental level? Do you think that India really, I mean, do you feel a sense of pride? Do you feel a sense of hope? Or do you think it's going to be more of the same?
Well, it'll largely depend on whether those same people who took to the streets are going to remain active politically. Will they vote? Will they run for office? Will they engage government on government's level, as opposed to what we've mostly seen, I think, is kind of that generation shunning the civil service and choosing the private sector. So will we see a change in career choice for some of these people? I think that remains to be seen. You know, when I lived in India, I kept saying, where is the revolution here? I'm waiting for the revolution. And I left India as the Mumbai attacks, just a few weeks after the attacks on, you know, the Taj Hotel and the Victoria Terminus and the Jewish center were unfolding. And I think you saw a little bit of mobilization after that, similarly on Facebook, lots of candlelight vigils, lots of pointing fingers at the government as to how security could be so bad. But then it kind of waned, and I'm hoping this is maybe a resurgence of some of that same feeling and some of that taking back of country. And, you know, maybe that's the closest a revolution that I'll get to see in my lifetime. I kind of hope not. I hope that we see a little more of this, because
okay.
there's definitely people demanding accountability from their government.
Okay. I'd like to thank you both very much for participating in the Feet in Two Worlds podcast.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Aswini, for having us.
The producers of this podcast are Jocelyn Gonzalez and Sarah Kate Kramer. Special thanks to the CUNY J School and our engineer, Chad Bernhard. Thanks for listening.
Feet in Two Worlds is supported by the New York Community Trust and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, with additional support from the Mertz Gilmore Foundation and the Cyrus Fund. This program was produced in association with the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism and CUNY TV. Feet in Two Worlds brings the work of immigrant journalists to public radio and the web. We are a project of the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. Visit our website at news.feetintoworlds.org.